Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show and podcast discussing nonprofit social justice and activism. I am your host, Ethan Clow, and we're broadcasting here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Well, good morning, everybody, if you're listening live here on CITR. It is a fantastic Friday morning, and Friday mornings are always fantastic because it's Friday. And if you're listening via podcast, well, welcome to the show, whatever time it is or whatever day it is. Maybe it's even earlier Friday morning on the next week, in which case, welcome to the future. Well, we have a great show today. We're going to be talking with David LePage on this new concept of social enterprise. Now, social enterprise is something that we mentioned on last week's show, and it sort of makes up this new and strange pillar in the community of sectors here in Canada. We, of course, all know about government, the for-profit sector, and the nonprofit sector. But now we have this idea of social enterprise, which is kind of like merging the for-profit and the nonprofit sectors. Now, if you're saying, well, that sounds a bit strange, how would that even work? What does that even mean? Well, you're not alone. It's a confusing idea, and it's not without controversy. David LePage is an expert in social enterprise, having been involved with many different projects, both on the nonprofit aspect of it, as well as how to develop a business plan and how to develop what they call blended return on investment, which is a new concept to this social enterprise idea. And we'll dive into this with David later in the show. So stay tuned. It's going to be really interesting. And later on in the show, we'll be discussing some news items, including a recent item about the lack of women in key leadership roles for nonprofits. Now, what is the effect of this gender imbalance when it comes to nonprofit leadership? As you can imagine, it's not good. So we'll discuss that and take a look at some of the issues related to this unbalance in the workplace. And of course, we'll have last week's big question. We'll take a look at some of the answers that we could apply to that question in particular. And then, of course, as always, we'll have our new big question of the week. So be sure to keep your ears peeled for that one. And I will, of course, give you all the information you need to participate in the big question of the week. But first, earlier in the week, as I'm sure many Canadians heard, we learned of the passing of Canadian writer Farley Mowat. I'd like to take a few moments to just pay some final respects to Mr. Mowat and discuss his impact here on Canada, as well as literature and, as well, social justice. Like most Canadians, I was first exposed to his works while in grade school. We read his book Owls in the Family and The Dog Who Wouldn't Be, and I remember being really fascinated by these books, like so many others. They just seemed to tell these stories of a glorious youth that we all wanted to have. It was kind of like a Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn kind of style, this kind of frontier life living on the prairies, being surrounded by all these animals and having these kind of amazing adventures that sort of only took place in books. I actually remember that we as a class wrote letters to Mr. Mowat, and I'm not sure what grade we were in. I think maybe grade 2 or grade 3, but he actually did write back. We got this big letter, which he addressed to the whole classroom, and he talked about writing his books, and he answered some of the questions that we sent him. It was quite an interesting experience. I don't think I have the letter that I initially sent him, and I don't really remember too much about what I asked him. I'm pretty sure it had something to do with owls or dogs, given the subject of the books. But, yeah, it was quite an experience. I mean, it was an interesting, thing to be able to get a response back from somebody that you were learning about. Later on, when I was in high school, we studied several of his books like Never Cry Wolf, which we looked at from both a literary point of view, but also a cultural and environmental point of view. And of course, one of the big things that he came to be associated with was environmentalism and activism. He put a huge spotlight on these issues well before anyone else in Canada did. And as someone who had a big impact on Canadian culture, you know, his voice, it carried a lot of weight. For many Canadians, he was their education on environment and particularly life in Canada's north. Most people were completely ignorant of what life was like in Canada's north and what it meant to be an environmentalist in Canada at that time. Of course, not everybody admired Mowat. He was criticized his entire career for factual errors in his books about the North and the Inuit people whom he often wrote about. More than that, he was accused of misrepresenting his experiences, you know, of which his books were supposed to be based on. Additionally, it was said that many of the things that he claimed to do were actually not true. He didn't actually do them. For instance, he didn't learn to speak Inuit. He didn't spend time in the Arctic by himself doing scientific research. And for the most part, Mowat actually admitted that this was in fact true. Famously, he said, quote, "I will take any liberty I want with the facts, so long as I don't trespass on the truth." And while on stage at the International Festival of Authors in Toronto, Mr. Mowat actually bellowed out, quote, "F the facts. The truth is what is important." He didn't actually say F the facts. I sort of cleaned that up a little bit. I'm sure you can imagine what he actually said. Now, normally, I'd have a big problem with that kind of attitude. That's the same sort of rhetoric we would expect from, say, anti-vaccine activists or, you know, some kind of Tea Party conservative Bible thumper. But in Mowat's case, he may have had a point. When Mowat wrote People of the Deer in 1952 and later Never Cry Wolf in 1963, he held up a mirror to the Canada that lived south of the Arctic and indeed, well, anywhere south of Edmonton, really. And he showed that we were a population relatively ignorant of what happened in the northern parts of our country. Indeed, many could argue that's still the case. The people here in southern Canada see the north as this big, empty wasteland, and it has resources like gold or diamonds or oil. And since no one is using those resources, we can just go up there and dig them up. Never mind the environment. The north is huge. There's plenty of environment to go around. And if there are some natives living up there, well, they can move. There's all this space. They can just pick somewhere else to live. You might even be tempted to make the comparison to right here in BC with the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which folks here in Vancouver and Victoria might want. And if people up north have a problem with that, well, you know, they can just move or get over it. And as I said, this attitude, which existed back in the 50s and 60s, well, also the 70s, 80s, and 90s, well, this attitude which existed for all the times, ultimately, what's more important from the Mowat point of view? Getting this, quote, truth out there, forcing Canadians to acknowledge it, or, you know, from a modern perspective, ranking Mowat over the coals because he dramatized some of the facts in his stories. Of course, that's a question that we're going to have to answer for ourselves. But as I've been reading the articles about Mowat over the past couple of days, I've been struck by how much of an impact he had on society. His books actually provoked heated debate in Canada's House of Commons. He spurred on actual, real changes. And for those of us who call themselves environmentalists today, and those of us that are doing and following in the footsteps of people like Mowat, we owe that to him. His books became inspiration for so many activists who would go on to be influences for many others still today. So, in the end, when we look back on Farley Mowat's life and his impact, we have to keep that in mind. Yes, maybe he dramatized some of the facts. And yes, maybe he didn't actually spend months upon months alone in the Arctic researching wolves. But when you look at the impact that he had, and the fact that he set out to have an impact, the fact that he set out because he saw some problems that needed to be addressed, that he saw issues that had to be looked at, that Canadians had to start thinking about, and the fact that he was successful, and it did make change. And even though we're still having the same problems, and even though it sometimes looks like things haven't gotten better, we do have to acknowledge the fact that Farley Mowat did a good thing, that he was able to make people aware of these issues, that he was able to have an impact, and ultimately, some people changed their minds. And those people who did change their mind, they went on to be influencers themselves. They went on to be people who would influence and lead a whole generation of environmentalism. And indeed, many of the people that we look up to today were people who looked up to Farley Mowat. Farley Mowat was born on May 12, 1921, and died only a few days before his 93rd birthday. A storyteller and an icon of Canadian literature and environmentalism. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector. While we're doing so, I am going to look up which books by Farley Mowat are in the library. And you know what? You should do the same, because we could all use a little bit of a reminder now and then about what it's like to be in the North here in Canada and what being an environmentalist means. We'll be right back after this break.
For a taste of the classics with a twist, join me, Marguerite, with Classical Chaos, Sunday mornings starting at 9, right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
And we're back here on The Sector. It goes without saying that in order for a nonprofit to be successful, it needs to be able to reach out to different people and encourage them to get involved either with donating or volunteering. And yet, according to an article on the Chronicle of Philanthropy, the nonprofit sector is having a major problem due to a lack of female leaders. A poll of 650 women who work at nonprofits say that by not putting women in key leadership positions, including board members or executive positions, these nonprofits are missing out on potential donations from women in society. The poll, commissioned by The Chronicle and New York's University George H. Heyman Jr. Center for Philanthropy and Fundraising, found that 44% of female nonprofit workers think their organization favors men over equally qualified women for chief leadership positions. 40% of women at large nonprofits, which are groups with 25 million or more in assets, said their organization did not put as much effort into identifying and soliciting affluent women as it does men. And as a result, their organizations were losing money that could have been donated to their causes. And only 36% said wealthy female donors were given the same respect as well-to-do men. The survey of 644 women who work full-time in the nonprofit organizations was conducted by a Harris poll last month. 62% of the women who took the poll said they have worked in the nonprofit world for 10 years or more. So there's some pretty significant data here. What should stand out for us, I think, is that the 40% of women who say that nonprofits are not approaching affluent women as much as they are approaching men. That's a intriguing statistic. I mean, it's troubling, actually. Evidence points that both men and women give in roughly equal amounts. Causes may be different. The style of giving might be a bit different. And maybe in some cases, the donor percentages and the progression on the donor scale might be different. But there's nothing to really suggest that men or women give more or less overall. Now, this is significant for a number of different reasons. The first being, it's not a controversial claim that the public will donate to causes that have people like them involved. If you're a minority group member, you're probably going to support an organization that has members of your group in them, simply because you feel that they will have a better idea on how to fix the problems that you experience. And this is very simple and basic. Even if you're an expert on a given field, you're going to donate to a cause or an organization that demonstrates to you that they have the necessary experience to take on that issue. Now, number two, we're talking about untapped potential. This is something that I've talked about on Radio Free Thinker with regards to the skeptic movement. Diversity isn't just window dressing. Having people who aren't, and for lack of a better term, like you around, means that they can present ideas and solutions that you would never have seen. To think outside the box literally means that sometimes you need to get people from outside the box inside your organization to help that process along. It's no coincidence that when we're stuck on a problem, oftentimes the only way to get past it is to get your mind off it, go do something else for a little while, and allow yourself to recharge, refocus, and come at it from a new perspective. Sometimes one of the best ways of tackling a problem is to ask somebody who doesn't have the same input that you've just had. Go to someone who hasn't heard the problem before, explain the situation, and see what they suggest. Lots of people do that. I do that. I'm sure you do that too in your jobs, because we know that thinking outside the box works. So diversity is a great way to have that process occur within the organization. And that's why it's untapped potential. As for this particular problem, the article argues that this lack of female leadership isn't insidious, which is probably true, but the impacts are quite serious. To quote the article, quote, Deborah Misch, director of the Women's Philanthropy Institute at Indiana University, said the lack of attention given to women as donors or board members was consistent with research she's conducted. Quote, they are not considered as major donors or perceived to be decision makers. That's a mistake, she says, because women tend to be much more loyal donors than men, and often better at asking their networks of women for donations and other resources. So again, I mentioned that there may be differences between how men and women progress as donors, how quickly they move from a one-time gift to monthly giving to large gifts. This could be an aspect in which women are more advantageous because they're more loyal or they're better at reaching out to their personal networks and getting in donations and resources. Although the news isn't all bad, while men lead most large organizations, the number of women working at nonprofits has increased over the past decade. Now, women make up about 82% of workers at small organizations. They make up about 74% at mid-sized groups, and about 59% at the big ones. However, this does seem to tie into another odd stereotype. It's often said that men go into the for-profit sector, and women tend to go into the non-profit sector. And usually there's some sort of conclusion drawn about this, that women are more nurturing or don't like the competitive environment of the for-profit sector. What do you think about this, listeners? Well, while you're considering that, let's go on to last week's big question. Our previous question was, do Canadians need to rethink their priorities for charity? So a bit of a reminder, the causes that Canadians support the most include health, social services, religion, education and research, and hospitals. And when we went over what causes that are supported by the different groups of generational cohorts, we noticed a few trends, namely the causes that normally don't get much support at all. Those include the environment, arts, election campaigns, and advocacy. Now, I think we can all agree that supporting health and social services is a very good thing. A lot of great stuff is done via these causes, and our society is made better because of it. However, it does beg the question, why aren't we more concerned about the environment, or arts, or advocacy? Climate change is becoming a bigger and more encompassing issue as time goes on. Likewise, there are so many issues that need to be brought to the forefront of the conversation in Canada. We've mentioned several civil liberties topics in the past that we think are very important. One possibility is that charities and organizations haven't done as well at making people aware and interested in donating. That could be a good reason why they don't rank higher in the minds of Canadians who are giving. Another reason could be that in order to make money, you need money. And those causes we mentioned, many of them lack the advertising funds that many of the health and social services charities have. Or perhaps it's because the people who care about these issues don't have the resources to make donations. Maybe there's a cultural barrier that we're just not seeing here. One of the interesting questions awaiting an answer is, what will this young generation of internet-savvy folks do? Generation Y and younger, these are the folks who are growing up with social media. Now, the standard dogma has been that social media is useful for sharing news and outrage, but not much else. It's a typical slacktivist argument. But what will this generation do once it starts earning money, entering the workforce, and contributing? Will they continue to support the same old, same old? Or will this young, internet-savvy, and up-and-coming generation value the environment and civil liberties and arts? Will those causes become a lot more popular? I think we could actually argue pretty convincingly that we've seen a taste of this in the rise of online advocacy. Look at groups like Anonymous or websites like Reddit. We've seen these sites, these organizations, these groups build support for protecting net neutrality or privacy rights and more civil liberties that are problems or potential problems that exist now that previous generations would never have thought about because they weren't an issue back then. Now, perhaps this is a sign of what future causes Canadians will want to support. Let's take a break here on the sector, and when we return, we will have an interview with David LePage on social enterprise. Stay tuned.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women, 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. Only question now is, what will you do? Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
Hey, what's wrong?
I've been looking for a job since I came to Canada, and I haven't found anything.
Have you tried WorkLearn?
What's WorkLearn?
Part-time jobs on campus for international undergraduate students just like us help me find a great job that's actually related to my studies.
Wow, I'll have to check that out.
You should. It's good pay, good experience, and good for your career. Just look for WorkLearn postings at www.careersonline.ubc.ca. You can even ask your profs and campus staff if they can create a job for you.
To participate in WorkLearn, you must be an international student seeking an undergraduate degree in a participating faculty and registered full-time, with a study permit valid for at least 6 months. For more information, visit www.careers.ubc.ca.
Joining us now is David LePage. David is a principal with Accelerated Social Impact, one of Canada's first incorporated social purpose hybrid organizations. His current engagements include founding member and chair of the Social Enterprise Council of Canada, member in the Social Enterprise World Forum Steering Group, member in the Canadian CED Network Policy Council, and member in Imagine Canada's Advisory Committee, member in British Columbia's Partners for Social Impact, Program Adjunct and Professional Advisory Committee in the Sandermoon School of Business and Social Enterprise Leadership. So, David, welcome to the show. Clearly, you have a robust background with nonprofits and social enterprise. So tell us, what is social enterprise and how does it fit in with the traditional view of the nonprofit sector?
Thanks, Ethan. I think what's really important to realize is that the view of social enterprise has to be seen as another tool to make nonprofits more effective in what they're trying to do, either in delivering on their mission or generating income. So social enterprise is really a verb. It's really a way to help the nonprofit sector be more effective, because I think we often think of that social enterprise is the goal, and really the real value is the social impact that is generated by the business that's operated by the nonprofit.
And what are some examples of social enterprise in our local community?
Well, I think that's kind of fascinating, because I don't think there's a business we've seen that hasn't been done by a social enterprise, but some of them that people would recognize locally might be groups like Potluck Catering in the downtown east side that does professional catering, creates some employment, and provides affordable food in the low-income community. Cleaning Solution, a janitorial service employing people with mental health issues. Matira, property management, really focused on affordable housing and housing supports for low-income communities. And then you go to the other side, and people would be familiar with some of the arts and cultural groups, which aren't often thought about as social enterprises in the term, but they are businesses operated by nonprofits, and so they're more concerned not about generating profits for shareholders, but using a business model to contribute to building a healthy community.
So in what ways are social enterprises different from charities and management and organization?
I don't know that different might be the right term, but I think what we have to understand is that social enterprise is actually a tool. It's as I mentioned earlier, it's a way that can help charities become more successful. So rather than relying only on donations and grants, it diversifies the revenue sources by generating income, but it also oftentimes complements or can, you know, be more effective in delivering on a mission.
And in terms of regulations, the CRA has certain rules that charities must follow. If a business is going to be a social enterprise, how are they regulated and how do they navigate sort of the tricky CRA rules?
Yeah, actually CRA rules are pretty, so we have to point out here that nonprofit is a means of incorporation. So a group incorporates either in the province or federally as a nonprofit, which says our primary purpose is a public good, not primarily private benefit. And then there are some nonprofits who meet certain criteria and are approved by Canada Revenue to become charities, which allows them to give tax receipts for donations. The charities have, if they're going to run a social enterprise, that is, if they're going to operate a business, that business has to be directly related to their charitable purpose. So they can, like, as an example, run a business if they're a let's take the Development Disabilities Association, a charity that supports people with certain disabilities. They run a business called StarWorks that creates employment opportunities for some of the people they work with. That's a directly related business. And so therefore, the primary purpose is to achieve their charitable purpose, not to make money, and is therefore a legitimate one. A related business. What would be an unrelated business would be maybe a thrift store operated by someone, and the thrift store is purely to make money and it's unrelated to the charitable purpose. They'd have to be a separate entity.
And how does the CRA judge the relation of the enterprise to the charity? Is that, are they given a bit of leeway, or does justification have to be quite strong?
Well, you're getting into some very difficult legal and kind of regulatory issues. But CRA is quite clear. If it's a related business and it's subsidiary, and they have some other exemptions like run completely by volunteers or renting out of excess space. But it's pretty clear if you're a charity, there are some definite restrictions on what you can do about running a business. But CRA doesn't, has also been very supportive of the social enterprise sector in really helping the charity and the nonprofit sector be able to say, can we use the business? And they're saying, yes, you can use the business. There's no problem operating a business if it meets this criteria. If you're trying to use a nonprofit structure or a charity situation to avoid taxes, nobody wants to support that. I mean, we don't support that. I don't think CRA supports it. I don't think the community at large supports it. But for those nonprofits and charities that want to run a legitimate related business to help them become more successful, then I think CRA is actually saying, yes, you can do that, but there are some parameters. So they're not against it. It's just that they're a regulatory body. So our advice always is, you know, check with, there's, you know, a number of lawyers who are very good at this, and check with your legal counsel and do your business planning, and you're fine.
With regards to the charities that are using social enterprise to suit their cause, what have you seen as sort of the best examples or the most innovative ideas?
Well, I think some of the interesting models are when you look at something like the Prince George Aboriginal Friendship Center that has a very large building that they bought 20 years ago. They actually are able to rent out the excess space. The income from that excess space can help pays the mortgage on the building and helps with some of their administrative costs. But in that same building, they run all of their social programs. They run a catering company, a training program for youth, a daycare center. So they've created within their charitable organization a full array of services, from daycare to lunch on Fridays for the elders, so, and all the employment supports, and as well as being involved in the community. There's other groups that run directly related business, like, you know, if you go to Toronto and look at the Toronto Enterprise Fund, they have a portfolio of about 15 different social enterprises, all of which are focused on how do we support people who are near homeless, on homeless, or in risk of homelessness to move into the employment services opportunities. So they use social enterprise as a really creative way to create employment for people with barriers, all within many different business models, but with the same mission. And then I think if you go like to places like Haida Gwaii, and you look at the Haida Gwaii Higher Education Society, which runs an accredited university program on Haida Gwaii, the community economic impact and the cultural sharing of that kind of model is pretty amazing. So I think you have to sort of explore, because it's such an array and it's so dependent upon a community need and how a charity is trying to meet that need. And then can a business model help them become more successful?
And one of the interesting things that's happening, especially with Generation Y and the people entering the workforce, is that organizations, corporations are noticing that their employees want to see community involvement. So we have a lot of, you know, big organizations, big companies that are getting invested in community outreach projects. Would this be in a similar vein to social enterprise, or is maybe this is a sign of success of the movement?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, I think we have to differentiate between corporate social responsibility and social enterprise. And I think some of the community engagement efforts have to be, what business is trying to do, a lot of the traditional businesses, they recognize that just being driven by profits is not going to be a successful business model, either with their young, Generation Y, as you refer to it, or is that employees want something more than just to work for a company who's only focused on the next quarter dividends. People are starting to say, what's our responsibility? You have people like Michael Porter from Harvard Business School talking about shared values. And so you've got a business community that's starting to realize that the old model of just making profits is not a very successful business model in the long term. And then you have on the other side, the nonprofit sector and the charities who are saying just being dependent upon gifts and donations isn't necessarily a very successful model. So we're actually seeing more and more nonprofits and for-profits start to look at, how do we blend community development, community values with a business model. So CSR, corporate social responsibility initiatives, are becoming more blended into the business activities. So things like employee engagement isn't necessarily, let's go clean up the community on Saturday. It has nothing related to our business value, but maybe it's a business value we can share and build something into our business that is more effective, like where do we buy our catering or who cleans our office. And so I think we're seeing a shift in both models. We're seeing a shift from the nonprofit sector to be more aware of business models they could use, and we're seeing the for-profit sector become more conscious of it's more than just a financial bottom line.
And one of the terms in social enterprise is the blended return on investment. So could you talk a bit about that and how for a nonprofit, how does that work and factor into their idea on a return?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting, it's a term that Jed Emerson coined now maybe 15 years ago when trying to explain social enterprise to some of the business community and to the nonprofit community. Whereas traditionally nonprofits looked at a social return on investment and businesses looked at a financial return on investment for a bottom line. But then he realized in social enterprise, and as we've gone forward on that, we've realized that social enterprise is really about this blended value return on investment, which means it's not financial or social, but it's actually financial and social. So when a social enterprise is having to make decisions, whether it's business planning or sales growth or employment or HR decisions, it's not just looking at going to create a social outcome, it's going to create a financial return, but it's really that they have to look at both. So in the business planning and in the business evaluation, it's really not just is the business successful, but is the business successful and is it helping us meet our social purpose? So it becomes really important for social enterprise to do the appropriate planning and to do the appropriate strategy development so they know what they're trying to do and how they're going to measure it, because then they can make those blended value decisions, because it's not easy. Because if you're just running one or the other, it's pretty simple. When you start doing social enterprises, that complexity of the working in a traditional marketplace with a social value or working in a traditional social mission with a business model, it can get a bit complex, and the importance of knowing what they're trying to do becomes so important and how they measure it.
Well, one of the concerns that I've read about with social enterprise is that it can lead nonprofits into areas where they aren't qualified, such as running a business, in addition to their mission and their cause, which is already, you know, very important and very difficult. What are your thoughts on this, and what sort of experience or skills would you recommend for nonprofits who are interested in social enterprise?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Ethan, because so many social enterprises do come out of people with really a strong social mission, strong background, without much business experience. And it's one of the things that the Social Enterprise Council and enterprising nonprofits have been really concerned about over the past 10 years is how do we build up the business acumen in the nonprofit sector, because that's such an important foundational piece to the success of social enterprise. So I think we're starting to see some shifts. I mean, we see that, you know, like ENP program, the Interweave program are both there helping build skills in the nonprofit sector. The Sanderman School of Business, the MBA program I'm involved in, is the first MBA that we're aware of that is actually focusing on social enterprise leadership. So how do we continue to build the tools and the resources? I mean, we have the Canadian Guide to Social Enterprise, lots of opportunities, but it really, those people and those nonprofit leaders who want to get into social enterprise have to build up their skills. I think what's fascinating to me is we're seeing more and more younger people coming out of business school with an interest in working in a social enterprise or a social purpose business. So that right away is bringing a new set of skills that is coming not from the social side, but coming from the business side. So I see it moving in that direction, and I see more tools being developed, more sophistication. And a lot of nonprofit managers run very sophisticated businesses. They just aren't aware it's really a business.
Excellent. Well, what do you see as the biggest challenges going forward in the future?
I think the biggest challenge is two-sided. One is, as we become more engaged in the marketplace, where social enterprise starts to be more competitive in terms of products and services, the demand side is starting to grow, and the demand side often has a lot of tough requirements. I mean, you've got to be competitive on price and quality, and then also deliver on social value. So I think where we're seeing some of the biggest challenges is how do we grow the marketplace? How do we build the capacity on the supply side to meet a growing demand? But on the other side, unless we grow the demand side and get more businesses and government to say we want to purchase with a social value built into our decision making, as we build that marketplace, those are new relationships and new challenges, and both sides will have tough decisions and tough processes to develop. Because what we're finding is the nonprofit side is used to getting grants and getting support to do good things because they do good things. The for-profit side is used to buying things only based on price and quality. So now all of a sudden you start to say, wow, we're working in this blended value situation in the marketplace by bringing a social value to the traditional marketplace. Those are new challenges, and I think it's going to take some innovation. It's going to take some learnings and some experiments, but we're going to see, as we're beginning to see, some real success that if we can use the marketplace effectively, we can actually grow the social enterprise sector dramatically.
Excellent. Well, David, let's quickly go to our pitch of the week. This is our weekly feature where we ask our guests to give us their best elevator pitch or their best pitch for a charity or a cause or a mission that you think is worthy. So David, what would you pitch?
I'm going to pitch something very close to what I'm working on right now, and that's the Buy Social Canada initiative, which we're launching in June at a summit in Vancouver, June 16th and 17th. And we're working with partners across Canada as we build a campaign to really push for a social value marketplace where Buy Social Canada becomes a way for purchasers and suppliers, social enterprises and people wanting to buy from social enterprises, to find some common ground and to build a marketplace that recognizes if we can put social values into the marketplace, we can build healthier communities.
Excellent. And just finally, David, for anyone listening, how can they get involved in a social enterprise or to learn more?
So I think there's a really great site that we've been working on for a number of years. It's enterprisingnonprofits.ca, or you can get to it by socialenterprisecanada.ca. And it's the most comprehensive social enterprise site in Canada and one of the best we've been recognized internationally for it. It's not only does it have access to a lot of the learning tools in terms of the development path, but it's got an entire public policy library. It's got a marketplace if people are looking for products and services. So a very comprehensive partnership between ENP and the Social Enterprise Council of Canada, with support from Employment Skills Development Canada and TELUS. And it's a big partnership to support having a common site for social enterprise in Canada. So it's enterprisingnonprofits.ca.
Excellent. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us on The Sector, and all the best of luck with your future projects.
Okay, thanks, Ethan. Talk to you soon.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station.
Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on.
College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on The Sector. So our thanks to David for speaking with us on social enterprise and for giving us his pitch of the week. Remember, we'll have the links that David mentioned in our show notes over at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And if you want to follow up with what David was talking about with regards to social justice or his pitch of the week, we'll have that information for you to do so as well. And now, as time is winding down, we should go on to our big question of the week. One of the most anxious moments for any fundraiser is the part where you ask a potential donor how much they wish to give. I've mentioned before how Canadians tend to be a bit awkward about talking about money. But of course, when you're fundraising, you have to talk money, and you have to ask, how much do you want to donate? What about the donor? How much do you think is appropriate? Now, assuming that you're not a millionaire, or that you have a prior relationship with this charity, what do you think is a good amount to give? So the big question of the week for a first-time donor, what is an appropriate, read fair, generous, proper, amount to give as your first donation to a charity? And not to try to sway the responses, but let's face it, many charities will ask anywhere between $10 and $100. What do you think? And give it some thought as the person giving money. Don't think about what the fundraiser wants to hear, or what you as a fundraiser wants to hear. Think about it as a person being asked for the first time. You're being asked to give to a charity. Perhaps you've just heard about this charity, you were stopped on the street by a fundraiser, or you were phoned up from a mailing list, or maybe you attended an event. Maybe you got a direct mail. Maybe you were just curious one day and you went surfing on the web and you found a charity looks interesting. When it comes time to give that first donation, what are you going to give? So think it over. Let us know. Remember, you can participate in our big question by emailing us at The Sector. Our email address is sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And you can comment on our posts on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, or tweet us on Twitter. You can tweet us at @sectorpodcast or at me, Ethan Clow. And of course, you can and should visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. There you can download past episodes in podcast form or find out more about us here on the show. Remember to tune in next week, Friday at 8 a.m., our usual time. We'll have on as guest Francois Herbert. Francois is one of the board members with Dying with Dignity Canada, obviously an organization that values civil liberties and personal freedoms. And not without controversy as well. So we'll talk with Francois about what it's like to be in a leadership position with such an organization, dealing with the controversy but also the battle of advocacy to convince Canadians and people around the world about the importance of civil liberties and personal freedom. We'll talk with her about what it's like to be in a leadership position with such an organization, and about the logistics that go into being a board member. What kind of responsibilities and duties go along with such a role? If you have any questions that you'd like me to ask, be sure to send them my way. And of course, we'll have a new question of the week, as well as news, commentary, and more discussion here on The Sector. Well, episode 7 has come to an end. My thanks to everyone for tuning in. Really appreciate it. And looking forward to your feedback. This is your host, Ethan Clough, signing off. See you all next week, right here on The Sector.